You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Welcome to the Cycling Podcast and our third rollout with our own Tour de France Attitude Camp with me, Graeme Wilgos, and once again joined by Lionel Burney. And Lionel, so many riders for their build up to the tour look to altitude. For you and I, once again, it's a case of, I'm going to call it psychological elevation gain, reaching, we hope, let's call it the peak of perception as we get our attitude spot on before we head out to Barcelona for the Grand Depart in only 2 short weeks.
How's morale, Graham? I'm feeling pretty good. I'm tuning up nicely for the tour, not overdoing it.
Like you, morale is high, very excited about it, not overdoing it. I just always find, particularly with the number of races that come so thick and fast at this point in the calendar, it's almost impossible to keep up. But you and I are going to do our best.
We are. I mean, the focus of this episode is very much the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes. Got it in one.
The race formerly known as.
Yeah, the formerly known as the Critérium du Dauphiné. And, well, a fantastic week of racing, I thought. Every day was just gripping viewing. We didn't quite get the end of the story that we were anticipating, but we got a victory for Mexico's Isaac Del Toro, racing his first road race event, stage race as a pro in France, and tuning up very nicely for the Tour de France. But the whole of France was waiting to see what Paul Sexas would do. And of course, he crashed on the penultimate day on Saturday. And, well, we didn't actually see what happened on the TV coverage, did we? So I thought we should ask the person who had a front row seat, Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, sitting in direction car number 2. His usual place is either behind the peloton or behind the brake. He's the man that's keeping his eyes on everything that's going on. He's relaying the information over the radio to all of the sports directors regarding which riders are in the brake and who's had a puncture and who's had a crash. And so my first question to Seb Piquet was, what on earth happened to Paul Sexas?
What happened to Paul Sexas? He crashed. That's certainly not what France was expecting, or maybe the world of cycling. But he did a mistake. He crashed. We were in the car behind the peloton. So basically, what happened is that the race was neutralized because there was a descent where there were gravels, and for the safety of the riders, and I think it was a good call. It was decided to neutralize the race for 15 kilometers for a descent. Okay. And then, bang, the race resumed. We took off. And after 1 or 2 kilometers on the left-hand side of the road, I see this tall gentleman standing up. He was standing up and he was shaking his hands like this in pain. But he was standing up, 2 riders with him. And we overtook him, and then we got news that he was still with the doctor, and he was going to get back on his bike, and he got back on his bike. So basically, what happened? Because I had a long chat with him after he made a mistake. He tried to overtake a rider in a descent on a turn and slid, and I mean he was at 70 kilometers an hour. He injured his hands. He basically burnt all his body. He was like a mummy at the finish and the next day for the start. And then there were the heroics, you know. He was 4 minutes behind, helped out by 2 teammates, Dan Hooler and Bissiger. And he managed to get closer to the peloton, 2 minutes, 1 minute 30. We were going up a first cap climb, and he managed to catch the leaders, the yellow jersey group. And then it was just too much, and Del Toro did his thing, and the others did their thing, and he couldn't recover, but still managed to finish the stage. And it was pretty heroic. And what was quite amazing was his reaction after the race. He came to do an interview, I asked him a very simple question, and it was basically, "Paul, what happened?" And he gave us a 4-minute answer where he said it was entirely his fault. He was completely stupid. He's really sorry. Sorry, he crashed. Sorry, he put others in danger. Said to the spectators looking straight at the camera, "And please always wear gloves when you're riding your bike, because if I didn't have gloves on that day, on during that crash, I no longer would have any hands." He was completely, but his hands were completely ripped to shreds, and injured, and he had gloves. And then he started talking about how amazing his teammates were, and finished the interview by saying, "You five guys, you should know it. I love you." And he's, such a mature individual who has no filters, maybe because he's 19. So that's what happened on that, I was going to say that sad day for French cycling, but it happens. Well, first of all, it started a debate. And the debate was, should he have continued racing after that crash? Should his DS should he have told him to, "Okay, you crashed, you're 4 minutes behind, there's nothing to gain, get back in the car, we'll take you back home, recover." Should he have resumed the race? Should he have started the next day? A lot of people, spectators, analysts, specialists, TV commentators, a lot of them said, "What's the point of getting back on your bike? You should have gone home. You should be recovering right now. You have a big race in 3 weeks' time. You're only fifth or sixth in the GC. There's nothing to gain. You should have stopped racing." So there was a big debate about that. And does it trouble his the expectations for his Tour de France? Maybe a little bit, because it shows that he's a human being, and he can crash, and he doesn't always win, and he's not always spectacular. So now we know that. Will it have an effect on his Tour de France? I don't think so. I mean, he has time to recover. It's only like burns and bruising, and normally he should be okay, because apparently no bone or tendon was touched.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
This episode is sponsored by NordVPN, the best and fastest virtual private network in the world. You've probably heard a lot about VPNs lately, and maybe you're curious about the benefits. Well, there's lots of them. Primarily, it's about internet security, protecting you from viruses and malware and phishing attempts, keeping all of your important data safe and secure whenever you're online. And I've been a NordVPN customer for a long time. And the reason I signed up in the first place was because when I was traveling, I was a bit unsure about the security of some of the internet connections I was using, whether that was public Wi-Fi in airports or hotels or cafes, or the Wi-Fi in the press room even. I had NordVPN installed on my laptop and really haven't looked back. I have it enabled on all of my devices whenever I'm online, and I know that it's just doing the job, keeping all of my data secure while I'm roaming around the internet. There are other benefits as well when you're traveling away from home, as Graham and I will be at the Tour de France in a couple of weeks' time. If you've got your paid subscriptions for your streaming services or sports events, you can carry on accessing your home content while you're traveling. And you can find a nearby server to make sure you get the best and fastest VPN speeds. Why not give NordVPN a try? Because you're a cycling podcast listener, you can get a fantastic deal when you sign up for a 2-year plan. You'll get 4 months extra for free at nordvpn.com/TCP. That's nordvpn.com/TCP.
Right then, Lionel. Very, very interesting indeed, given that what we ended up with was not the race we thought we might, but a really interesting 6 minutes from Seb Piquet on Paul Sexass there. But he doesn't think it changes things too much for the tour. And, from our point of view, it it's almost not quite a reality check, but it just sort of turns down the volume a bit of what we might expect, and maybe just kind of in a way, him not coming and blowing everyone away at the Dauphiné might have helped not only Sexas but Decathlon CMA CGM.
Yeah, I mean, we were all anticipating seeing how he would go as the outright leader and the pre-race favourite. But is Paul Sexas going to win the Tour de France in 2026? No matter what, I think it's unlikely. A victory in the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes might have just turned up the anticipation and the excitement and the glare of that spotlight to an almost intolerable level for him. And I think they will have learned an awful lot from the week. I mean, it wasn't the only day that went far from to plan for Decathlon, was it? I mean, they kind of surrendered their grip on the race. They didn't really race in the way that Visma Lisa Bike or UAE Team Emirates would do when they're trying to kind of assume the leadership of the race. Of course, they didn't have the leader's yellow jersey, so, you know, why should they? But when people ask why do Visma Lisa Bike and UAE almost sort of squeeze the life out of races in the mountains, they take control so early, they ride on the front, whether or they've got the leader's jersey or not. And we sometimes think, well, they're, you know, they're really sort of dampening the tension and the drama and the excitement for us as spectators. I think the week we saw in France tells you why those big experienced GC teams ride the way they do, because Decathlon didn't really do that at key points. They let things get out of hand a little bit. We'll go into a bit more detail about that in a bit, but they will have learned that you can't, there's no kind of room to let things get out of control. And they did that a couple of times. The crash, Sexas admitted it was rider error. He'll have learned something about that too. But they were already on the back foot a little bit, chasing to try and get back into contention. If there's a positive, it's how well he chased over the back half of Saturday's stage. I mean, to get back up to the yellow jersey group in the first place. All right, the racer got away from him again and he was nursing injuries. But they did get back into the right position at some cost, I would have imagined. And of course, then not managing to complete the stage on Sunday. You know, probably in hindsight, it would have been wiser to have not lined up at the start on Sunday for Sexas and just say, look, we're not going to gain anything here, as Seb said. But an interesting week, and you learn more from adversity than from just steamrolling the opposition and everything going perfectly to plan.
Yeah, it was a sort of joyously upside-down race, wasn't it, to give it the kind of big picture, in which no team really had a hold on it. I know Alex Baudin spent a long time for EF Education Easy Post in the leader's jersey, but it almost felt like, with the, you know, the greatest of respect, it felt like he was sort of keeping it warm, as we say, before handing it over to the team that was really going to take control. And we didn't see a team really take control, or a rider really take control, until those final two stages. But I don't want to run away from Paul Sexas too far. I thought it might be quite interesting to take a look back at L'Équipe, the sort of official sporting record for France, their kind of week in front pages. I always think that's quite a good barometer. Certainly you and I, when we're at the Tour de France, always use that as a sort of, I don't know what you'd call it, a kind of moodometer for how France is feeling and kind of what the kind of the most important story of the day is as you go through it stage by stage. But go back to last Sunday, and Sexas is, or on a Sunday, you know, L'Équipe do more than one front page, but he was one of their standalone front pages. And their headline was warm-up lap, you know, as the big favourite for the Tour of Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes. This was, to all intents and purposes, Sexas's warm-up for the Tour de France. And it was, you know, a case of, we're not only looking ahead to Sexas and Decathlon dominating this race. I mean, I'm sort of inferring an awful lot from this headline, but I think it's kind of fair enough. Not only are we looking at that, but we're looking at, well, we're getting really excited about the Tour de France here too. But then you have to go through, you know, Monday you've got Metz women, the handball champions, handball Champions League winners. Tuesday you've got, obviously, when the World Cup build-up friendlies phase, so Michael Elise's hat-trick, London's own Michael Elise's hat-trick against Northern Ireland. Wednesday, they've gone for a headline in English, welcome to the USA, with some of their best work, in my humble opinion. Gianni Infantino, the head of FIFA, as a hand puppet with Donald Trump with his hand up Infantino's backside alongside the Somali referee, Omar Artan, who was denied entry to the US to officiate at the World Cup, and an ICE agent on the other side of Trump, who in his other hand is holding the World Cup. Anyway, moving on. Thursday, yet more World Cup build-up with Lamine Yamal, Lionel Messi and Kylian Mbappe. Still no sex ass, even in the subheads. So it's all gone very quiet getting into Friday. Very sad front page. Charlie Darlene, the round the world solo sailor and the most recent winner of the Vendée Globe, who died at the age of just 42. He was the standalone front page there. So you've got to wait until Saturday until, with a subhead, L'Équipe say that Sexass had it still with it all to do. But even then, you had Kylian Mbappe and the French football team being the leader. Sunday, Michael Olise again, on which foot to dance? Is it Olise that the French team go with, or is it Ousmane Dembele? Will they go with one or the other? Will they go with both? Sexass again relegated to the subhead of tested by the crash. So insofar as L'Équipe and possibly France's excitement, they've had something of a... I'm going to go back to using the words reality check, because let's remember, still 19 years old, still with not that much experience of stage racing, certainly on the biggest stage, going into his debut.
Yeah, I mean, just to temper that, I mean, it's been in recent years quite unusual for the Dauphiné, as it was, to be on the front page of L'Équipe. I mean, sometimes the Tour de France gets relegated on the front page of L'Équipe these days, especially in a World Cup year. So I think the fact that Sexass is in the consciousness of the French public already, and that they were kind of following this journey through the week, anticipating another sort of lightning whirlwind stop on the Sexass hype train journey towards Barcelona, I think there has been a reality check, and that will no doubt kind of resonate back through the team. But across the whole week itself, I thought it was a great week of racing. I mean, when we discussed the opening three stages last week, Graham, I'd never really imagined a world in which we'd talk in quite such forensic depth about a team time trial. But this format has really worked well, and it set up the rest of the race beautifully, I thought. The fourth stage, we did a little stop press because that was last Wednesday, the day that we recorded. And that was the stage to Montrond-les-Bains. A brilliant, gripping day. A break of 10 got away and stayed away. They were almost caught in the finale, but they stayed just clear. And Quinn Simmons, the American champion, won the stage for Lidl Trek ahead of Finn Fisher-Black. I mean, it was real good nip and tuck, sort of transitional stage racing, that, wasn't it? There was a moment where it looked like Visma Liesebrink were going to bring it all back together again for Wout van Aert, who did win the sprint for 11th, sort of foreshadowing something that would happen a little bit later on. But the fact the break stayed away, I think, spoke to, firstly, the fact that neither UAE were particularly keen on, you know, riding too hard on the front and riding as GC leaders until they actually had a jersey to defend. Decathlon, I thought, showed a little bit of inexperience, not getting in there as well and just doing something just to hold it all together. But the big factor was that there's hardly any sprinters in the race this year. I mean, Van Aert beat Brian Cockar, who is a decent sprinter, and Phil Bauhaus, who is fast but hasn't won a race for 2 years, in that bunch sprint.
As some people on this podcast predicted last week, Wout van Aert gearing up for a stage
indeed
win.
Indeed, he was, Graham. I'll let you have your moment in the sun in just a moment, because stage Thank five you. Went to the Bird Park at Villa Les Dômes, and this time they got it spot on, didn't they? Another big break went clear, but Visma Liesebrink kept everything in check all day, and Van Aert finished it off. And I mean, I saw it a little bit differently. I thought maybe this was just a week of getting himself back up to speed. He's had a few difficulties of late, hasn't he, Van Aert? He had a crash in training before this race, and I wondered...
Oh, it's his right elbow, wasn't it? And that was the reason that he eventually pulled out. I mean, you saw even with his sprint win on stage five that he was patched up with his right elbow. And that was the reason, certainly given by the team, that he withdrew from the race in the end. But, I mean, it, you know, he'd kind of done what he'd set out to achieve by that point. And I think they could see the way the race was going as well. So they certainly, from Van Aert's point of view, and from the team's point of view, looking ahead to the tour, it was the smart move to withdraw him.
I mean, five decent days of racing, a victory, and then spare himself the sort of the slog through the mountains when he can go and train where he's setting the parameters of his own efforts much more specifically rather than responding to what's going on in the race. And obviously with the swollen elbow being a bit sore, safety first for Wout van Aert. Now, Friday's stage to Crest-Voland, the first properly uphill finish of the race. I thought this was a fantastic stage. Everything you want to see from any kind of stage race in the mountains. There was a break of 60 riders went clear. Every team was represented except Decathlon for Paul Sexas. Tudor had five guys in there. Lotto, Groupama, Uno X, Red Bull and Soudal, Quickstep all had four. So it was a real beefy break. I mean, it wasn't really a break, was it? It was half of a peloton up the road. And
Well, it, like you say, and if anything, Decathlon did well not to be in that move, given that it was so well represented by literally every other team.
Clearly made a choice not to go in it, but they didn't ride hard enough to kind of keep it under control, because the race got away from them over the closing stages and the gap was still, you know, 4.5 minutes in going into the final 30, 40K. I suppose they were leaving some of it to EF Education Easy Post, who still had the yellow jersey on the shoulders of Alex Baudin. But I think they would have known that he would probably lose it on the final climb.
And so it was, look, it's almost EF saying to Decathlon, look, you've got the golden boy on board. Yes, we're in the jersey, but actually it's really on you to close this gap and it's on you to ride. And more than anything, you haven't got anyone in this break. But the gap just kept going up. And despite the efforts on the front of the chase group, on the front of the peloton, you know, even though effectively you had two pelotons on the road, yes, we did see EF putting some effort in for the chase, as we saw as well with a bit of help from net company Ineos. But, I mean, really, this was where Decathlon's race and Paul Sexas's race began to unravel.
It did unravel, and I was kind of sort of shouting at the screen, wondering why they weren't being a bit more proactive, because they could presumably see it was getting away from them. And all they needed to do was kind of lend a hand. Maybe they thought, look, we're so outnumbered here, there's so many riders in the break that even if we put the whole team on the front, we're going to be outnumbered. But they could have maybe trimmed it down a little bit getting to the final climb. The most dangerous riders in that break were Luke Tuckwell of Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. He was only 1 minute and 3 seconds off Alex Baudin's yellow jersey. Bruno Armerai of Visma Lisa Bike, he was 120 down. And then Guillaume Martin of Groupama was 151 down. So the yellow jersey was up for grabs. And more importantly, Sexas was in a position where he needed to not be behind too many riders. He was already behind a few riders as a result of the team time trial and what had gone before. But as the brake started to shatter on the final climb, there was a leading trio that got themselves clear at the front. And it was initially Maxime Van Hiels, Tobias Halland, Johannessen and Steinhauser, who was dropped and then replaced by Pablo Torres of UAE. And then in the group behind, we did see Paul Sexas kind of taking up the mantle. But it was clear at that point it was a little bit too little, too late to kind of, you know, catch the rest of the break and actually contest the stage. But it was interesting that Isaac Del Toro of UAE was the first to react, and he reacted very well. Matteo Jorgensen of Visma, he reacted pretty well, but couldn't stay with them for, you know, much more than sort of a couple of kilometres, I think. You know, he was distanced, and then it was Del Toro and Sexas away. And meanwhile, up front, Red Bull, Bora Hansgrohe were playing a blinder because Tuckwell got himself up to Torres, Van Hills and Johannessen. And before we knew it, it was two Red Bulls, Van Hills and Tuckwell. And they only had one rider to contend with. It was Johannessen. And they knew they had a chance of both the yellow jersey and the stage win. And that's exactly how it worked out. Tuckwell did some impressive work to kind of help set up Van Hills for the final move. A really impressive victory for Van Hills when you consider how disrupted his season's been. Crashed in back in February, just kind of getting back up to speed just in time for the Tour de France. A great day of racing, and it was one of those days where you looked at the GC and realised that, what was it, five of the top six on GC had been in the break, which really, you know, it really upset the order of things. And in the sort of virtual GC, suddenly Tuckwell was a bit of a threat, but Jorgensen still ahead of Seksas overall by quite a margin at that point. So it was really all in the balance.
Yeah. I mean, that was the day, really, that certainly hammered home for me the fact that, okay, well, this Dauphiné is not going to go to plan. Or, you know, you can make an argument that it certainly did go to plan for UAE in the end. But that was the day that, I mean, it's one of those joyous days of racing that maybe come around once or twice in a season, where it's just completely unexpected and it's almost impossible to call where it's going to go and how it's going to finish and who's going to finish strongest. But we've gone from the beginning of the week, and certainly last time you and I spoke, talking about how UAE had an awful lot of making up to do and catching up to do with Isaac Del Toro, to, I mean, I think we can sit here with the race over and look at these final two stages thinking, well, actually, they played a blinder.
Yeah, they did. I mean, when you look at how it shook down, you know, these two races within a race, 19 riders from the break stayed clear of the GC group in the end. And then the order over the line really was a kind of phony GC, wasn't it? Del Toro, Seksas, Jorgensen, and then the little Trek duo of Skelmoser and Juan Ayuso. So it looked like, right, we've got two more big days in the mountains. The order is set. You know, Kian Uytdebroeks of Movistar, he slipped back a bit. Some of the other riders have slipped back a bit. So we're now down to a real handful of riders. We know how this is going to work out over the final couple of days. Of course, the team that had a very difficult day on Friday was Netcompany Ineos because, well, first of all, Josh Tarling crashed, and then Oscar Onley had a terrible crash and ended up, well, his fall was basically broken on the descent by a tree. He ended up landing in a tree, dislocated his shoulder, some other injuries, and crossed the line almost half an hour down. And when I was talking to Seb Piquet, he made the point that they went past the Netcompany Ineos bike. He spotted the number. It's Oscar Onley's bike, but absolutely no sign of Onley on the road, and feared the worst, really. I mean, it was a nasty one, and very fortunate that Onley was able to get back on and finish the stage, but was a non-starter for stage seven. And we wait to see what impact that has on the Tour de France for Netcompany Ineos.
Yeah, hugely unlucky day, particularly in the context of looking ahead to the Tour for them, because Josh Tarling, that puts his, you know, broken collarbone puts his Tour de France in doubt. Geraint Thomas, talking afterwards, spoke about how Oscar Onley had not only dislocated his shoulder, he also said he'd taken a chunk out of his knee. And we know how difficult that can be if you're, you know, particularly when you're a climber, and particularly when you're as slight as Onley, when you're looking forward to the mountains. The other, I mean, that was effectively, that stage six was effectively Decathlon's race overall. But it was also, despite their efforts on stage seven, which we will come to, but it was also effectively, certainly, Netcompany Ineos' race over, because Kevin Vaucelain dropped 13 places on the GC to 15th. So, you know, last time we spoke, we talked about how they were kind of going in with, you know, were they not going in with that two-pronged attack of Vaucelain and Oscar Onley? And in the end, you know, 15th was as good as Vaucelain could do.
Yeah, and a word for Luke Tuckwell, because, I mean, what a ride to be up there in the first place and to take the yellow jersey. He's a name that we sort of saw on the periphery in the Tour of Romandy a month ago, finished sixth overall, and it's like, oh, that's a name worth noting. And well, I wasn't quite expecting him to produce the sort of level of performance. You know, getting the jersey is one thing, but then the way he backed that up over the closing couple of stages was really impressive.
It was a really tender, emotional interview, what we saw from Luke Tuckwell afterwards, devoting his win to his sister. And it kind of gave it that extra layer of meaning for the race. And as a way for a rider that we've not been familiar with previously, as a way for him to kind of burst onto the scene and introduce himself, it felt really powerful and a really lovely way to kind of add that, you know, extra layer of meaning to what is at the end of the day just a race.
Yeah, and I think as an armchair spectator, which we were, I would imagine everyone was rooting for him on Saturday to keep the yellow jersey. And again, that's the mark of a breakthrough performance like this. Yes, get the yellow jersey, but then to defend it on Grand Colombier, which is one of the hardest climbs in France, a really excellent ride by Tuckwell. I mean, they rallied around him when they needed to. Red Bull bore a hands grow, didn't they? And they protected him when they needed to. But this was another absolutely fantastic stage, all shaped around the crash on the descent for Paul Sexas, and the fact that, you know, he had a couple of teammates with him and this incredible chase. And at the time, we didn't really know.
60 kilometres.
We didn't know the extent of his injuries. So I was wondering, if he gets back on, and you know, what's he going to have left to contest the final part of the climb? And it was, well, so nearly. I mean, it was heroic, wasn't it? But it was so nearly, you know, the perfect kind of dramatic storyline that the whole of France and all French cycling fans are kind of crying out for. But ultimately, when it all kicked off on that final climb, it was just a bit too much for him. And we saw Isaac Del Toro, who had ridden a really smart, methodical week. He seized the initiative when he needed to. Juan Ayuso put himself into the red and probably did too much at one point and paid for the effort. And then it was a case of, you know, they're riding for themselves, weren't they? Matteo Jorgensen was, you know, sensing the opportunity to perhaps move into yellow, but didn't quite get the time that he required. But he ended Saturday, you know, kind of in the driving seat a little bit, assuming that Tuckwell would falter, which he did a little bit on Sunday.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
This episode is also sponsored by Car Gurus. Buying a car is a big decision, no matter what sort of car you need, whether you need something to ferry your team around, by which I mean your family, of course, something that can really cope with a lot of miles, or you just need something for commuting or for getting around town. Car Gurus can give you the facts first. Vehicle history, price changes, dealer reviews, everything you need to spot a great deal, steer clear of any surprises and get the best possible price. Because Car Gurus puts you in the driver's seat. You can look up the complete car specs and the history of the car, price change information, and be confident that you're getting a good deal. With Car Gurus, you get access to hundreds of thousands of cars from top-rated dealers, so you can find the best price, check out the mileage, the condition, all of that stuff. And with Car Gurus, you get real-time alerts for price drops and new listings as well, so you'll never miss a deal if you're looking out for something specific. Join the millions who have already found their best deal with Car Gurus. Go to cargurus.co.uk for complete vehicle details without any surprises. That's cargurus.co.uk. Car Gurus. Search, buy, sorted.
So Isaac Del Toro, Lionel, he said after stage 7, I just tried to be smart and wait until the last moment. I mean, that was stage 7 in a nutshell, but it was also the Notts Dauphiné, the Tour of Auvergne-Rhône Alpes, in a nutshell too, because we went from beginning of the week talking about Sexas probably being the head and shoulders favourite, certainly as, you know, sort of, I say we, I mean the media as a whole, the cycling media as a whole, and Ayuso and Del Toro being the kind of, you know, the distant second and third in terms of the favourites for the GC. And what we got in the end was a real power play from Isaac Del Toro. And certainly on stage eight, he was head and shoulders.
Yeah, he was. I mean, a real punchy, hard stage on Sunday, 120 kilometres, but climbing right from the start on not just any climb, the Col du Pre. It's a hard climb. And, well, you know, that was given that Seksas was struggling with his injuries. Perhaps it wasn't a surprise that he was in difficulty very early on. But UAE Team Emirates, who had a kind of an uncharacteristically reserved week, really. They timed everything to perfection. And Del Toro, I mean, he climbed so well. And when he got himself out in front, there was really, you know, no chance for anyone else to get back on terms. It was a Pog-esque attack. And it was clear fairly early on that it wasn't just going to net him a second consecutive stage, but he was also going to take the yellow jersey and the overall win, which he did in the end by almost a minute ahead of Tuckwell, who, I mean, what a ride again to hold on to a place on the podium.
8 kilometres, just over 8 kilometres, Isaac Del Toro rode to win that final stage on his own, just out in front. And he looked really comfortable. He didn't, you know, he looked like he was in fourth gear for most of it. And it was a bit of a masterclass, really.
It was. And, you know, we've seen, well, since the Giro d'Italia last year, where Isaac Del Toro was kind of only really upended right at the end, wasn't he? I mean, he was kind of caught not quite doing one thing or the other and ended up finishing second overall when Simon Yates turned the tables on everybody. It wasn't just Del Toro who got caught out that day, but he's really developing rapidly. All of those wins in Italy.
You feel like he's learned from that.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at his stage races this year, he's won the UAE Tour. He's won Tirreno Adriatico. Crashed out in Itzulia, and now he's won the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes. And he's going to go to the Tour de France as part of Tadej Pogacar's support team, but he's going to be one of those riders who I think he's going to be up there by default, isn't he? Because he's going to be able to handle the same sorts of stages as Pogacar. He can cope with punchy one-day race type terrain just as well as he can cope with you know, the big climbs, as he's proved this past week. So it's a really fascinating, well, there could be a little bit of a power play. I mean, no one's going to suggest that Del Toro is going to usurp Pogacar as team leader, far from it. But he's a very, very handy rider to have there as a number two. And Visma Lisabike will probably feel the same with Matteo Jorgensen, who looked a little bit leggy at times, perhaps the result of the layoff after the crash at Amstel Gold, but he was climbing well at times. He just didn't quite have the top end when it really counted at the sort of the very tail end of stages. But he's going to slot into Visma Lisabike's train for Jonas Vingegaard, and it's really set the Tour de France up fantastically, hasn't it? It just leaves us wondering about Paul Seksas and how good he can be at the Tour de France, because we didn't get to see him tested over those final couple of mountain stages.
Again, yeah, but that leaves questions unanswered. And I really like that when we're looking forward to the Tour, because it's not a done deal. We've not seen the best of Paul Seksas, and maybe it's better that we have to wait for the Tour before we can really see those fireworks from him. And, you know, fingers crossed we do. Interesting thing on Matteo Jorgensen for Team Visma Lisabike. The podium was up for grabs for him at the end there, but like you say, he didn't quite have it in him. And so the top three for the overall, I think we're all really pleased to see Luke Tuckwell for Red Bull, Bora Hansgrohe tuck in behind Isaac Del Toro in first place, almost a minute behind. But then Juan Ayuso, 1 minute 17 for Little Trek, and then Matteo Jorgensen, who was in, you know, he dropped 2 places overall on that final day. So whether he could see it falling away and knew that it just wasn't there, or whether he absolutely gave it his all to finish ahead of Tobias Halland Johansson for Uno X Mobility at 1:46, the kind of best of the rest, we don't know.
Yeah, Ayuso and Skelmoser were often riding together, weren't they, for Lidl Trek. They found themselves in the same group, sometimes just the two of them together. And that looks like a very useful tandem. but neither of them are quite good enough, I don't think, to trouble the podium at the Tour de France. But they're going to be, you know, it's super consistent, I would say. Oh, I mean, that should be a yellow card for me there. Super consistent. They're going to be consistent through the Tour de France, and they give Little Trek some options. You know, when it comes to the not just the GC, but also getting in breaks in the mountains and trying to win stages. The other rider of the week that I was impressed with was Tobias Halland Johannessen. Now, we know all about him. He finished sixth in the Tour last year. He was got in the big break on the stage to Crest-Voland on Friday and finished second, you know, heartbreaking second, really. But he was being outfoxed by the Red Bull duo, but he really thumped his front wheel on the... you know, bounced his front wheel in frustration, didn't he, at that second place?
Well, that was great. It was a great photo finish moment because the photo finish caught it. So the photo finish caught his front wheel up in the air as Tobias Halland Johannessen crossed the line. But really, to quote you, super consistent end to the week for him. Second on stage six, as you say. But then stage seven and stage eight came in third place on both days.
So... Isaac Del Toro, is he going to be the second UAE Team Emirates rider on the podium at the Tour de France? It's got to be on the cards. You know, it's a possibility, isn't it?
It's absolutely a possibility. I'm going to take you back to the predictions episode where I said that my second prediction for the year was Del Toro second on the podium behind Pogacar. But I don't think we've really seen Tadej Pogacar ride in a kind of two-up tactical format for Team UAE before this tour, but you've got to expect Del Toro to have a real level of protection. And yes, he will still be there for Tadej Pogacar to use, but at the same time, he's really shown his class, and he's given Team UAE every reason to protect him and kind of keep their powder dry with him too as a second option. We will get into this, or I will get into this, or have got into this with Andy McGrath, our press room colleague, who's written a book on Tadej Pogacar, on just how important Isaac Del Toro could be to his tour this year. But I'll sort of cut this short and just say that Pogacar riding on his own, as we usually see him towards the end of those mountain stages, if he was that tired at the end of the 3 weeks last time round, and we sort of saw that kind of real fatigue creep in for him, I think that Del Toro will be an absolutely huge asset for him this time round. And I think it can only, well, of course it can only benefit him, but it might actually be quite refreshing for Pogacar to have a teammate who can keep pace to a point.
Yeah, your conversation with Andy McGrath will form part of our kind of XL Tour de France preview episodes, which will go out in the week leading up to the tour. So we'll look forward to that. I mean, there were a few other pointers for the Tour de France, I thought. But one thing that really stood out across the week in France was just how few opportunities there were for sprinters. I mean, not many sprinters in the field anyway. Wout van Aert, not really a bunch sprinter. He's a world-class rider who's got a very fast finish, and he has won bunch sprints before, but he's not one of the sort of Jonathan Milan, Jasper Philipsen type sprinters, is he? He's a different beast. And the sprinters, no real opportunities to tune up for the tour, either in France or really at the Tour de Suisse, which gets underway tomorrow, Wednesday. So the sprinters have been dotted around here, there and everywhere over the last week or so. There was the Copenhagen Sprint World Tour race in the Danish capital, and that was where Jasper Philipsen beat Tobias Lund Andresen and Sam Welsford there. The Muir Classic Hellasbergen, which was a kind of classic sprint event, was won by Paul Manier, continuing his good form from the Giro d'Italia, where he won the points competition, the Ciclamino jersey. And the Circuit Franco-Belge one-day race, Corbin Strong won that. So sprinters getting their opportunities elsewhere, but not in the traditional Tour de France build-up races. Manier won't be going to the Tour de France, but Philipsen will, for sure. But the most extraordinary race finish of the week, Graham, was at the Grand Prix Gippingen in Switzerland. Liam Slok of Lotto Antimarché was clear. He'd launched his late attack, soloing to the line. coasting towards the line, arms ready to go above his head in victory celebration. He took a little half turn just to check that the chasers weren't behind him, and his front wheel went from under him. And he, well, it was a sort of Superman effort across the line, wasn't
Superman,
it?
back first across the line, one leg in the air, wasn't it? He really, he played it brilliantly to that point, and he picked his moment and he out-sprinted in, on that climb to the finish, because it's an 11-lap race, isn't it, in and out of the Swiss border town, which is effectively what it is, Gippingen, with Germany. But he played it brilliantly, out-sprinted both Alexander Vlasov for Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe and Richard Carapaz for EF Education Easy Post on his sort of tour warm-up train, on the climb to the line, quite comfortably so, to the point where he'd bought himself enough time to put his hands over his head in disbelief and kind of soak up the joy of his first professional victory. But in the process, he lost control of his front wheel. His front wheel skids out from underneath him and he crosses the line, you know, as you say, with that kind of real Superman, well, extraordinarily awkward Superman effort with one leg in the air, kind of back first, but both man and bike skidded across the line just ahead of Vlasov. But it's a first professional win that he will remember, and I think we will all remember for some time.
Can you imagine if he'd been pipped to the line by Vlasov? I mean, it wasn't close in the end. I mean, he won it. There was no need for the photo finish to decide the winner. But yeah, crossing the line, man and bike have to cross the line together in order to register a result. It could have been a lot worse.
He said afterwards, luckily the win came with it. Otherwise, this would probably have been the fail of the year. he said it feels a bit silly, but above all, I'm just incredibly happy. And he did, after a minute or so on the ground, he did pick himself up, sheepishly roll the few metres to where his team and his soigneur could kind of take a proper look at him and get out of the way of the rest of the finishers. I'm always curious to see, it's always quite a helpful tool, pro cycling stats, and you've got that, you've got all the other race information that you expect, average speed of the winner, the classification of the race category, how many vertical meters, etc. But the one how section, I was curious to see what they put on there and whether they'd say a sort of a back first slide across the line with one leg in the air, but it reads sprint of small group. It doesn't quite tell the full story, and I rather hoped it might read, I don't know, accidental front flip across the line. But it's congratulations are in order to Liam Slok, 25 years old, rode the Vuelta last season. I think that's probably the first that most of us would have really kind of paid attention to his being in the peloton. But a win's a win, as they say.
Absolutely right, yes. And, well, our attention will turn now, won't it, to the Tour de Suisse, this new condensed Tour de Suisse, 5 stages, all circuits. There's a time trial in there as well. And it's Tadej Pogacar's return to racing for the first time since the Tour de Romandie at the end of April, beginning of May, which he won, of course, still nursing a worst result this season of 4th in stage 3 of that race. Oh, no, 6th in the prologue in Romandie, actually.
There you go.
Terrible. Yeah. I mean, standard slipping there, Hog.
It's panic stations, if anything, for the tour.
Yeah.
But as you say, circuits every day, hills rather than mountains too, in this new reformatting of one of the oldest stage races going, and the kind of what used to be the alternative warm-up race for the tour, as well as being a prestigious race in its own right. It's an interesting start list still. Looking beyond Pogacar, Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe have got Primoz Roglic and Finn Fischer-Black, who we know is on form. Not suggesting for a second that Roglic will be going to the tour. Matthew Brennan for Team Visma Lisa Bike. He's had a very quiet season. Obviously, he was supposed to make his Milan-San Remo debut and had to pull out with illness, I think, before that could happen. So good to see him back. I think it's most likely to be one Atacanta overall by Tadej Pogacar, but those individual stages with Mathieu van der Poel, for example, for Alpecin Premier Tech, Caden Groves too, you know, what a brilliant tour he ended up having last year, despite effectively being Alpecin's third choice for their finishers, if you like. There's a lot of intrigue that goes along with this one too.
There is. Tom Pidcock, though, has pulled out. He missed a few days of training in Sierra Nevada with a viral infection. And although he's feeling okay, he won't do the Tour de Suisse. Instead, he'll do the one-day race in Andorra on June the 21st instead. Thijs Benoot makes his debut for the Decathlon team after his transfer across from Visma Lisabike. He was going to be a big part of their Classics campaign, but he has had a hernia and is only just ready to start racing for his new team. And as things stand, he is on the long list for the Tour de France as well, for Decathlon to be part of the Paul Sexas Support Act. So see how he goes this week. One other rider making his seasonal debut. No, not quite. Thibaut Nace is riding his first stage race of the year. He did his first race of the season at the Grand Prix Gippingen. He finished fourth, just off the podium. Probably had just about had a view of Liam Slok's Superman effort.
Mm. And Richard Carapaz will return, who had a front row seat to that Superman slide across the line. Carapaz will be presumably leading EF Education Easy Post's charge. And they're going with a reasonably strong team too. Vincenzo Albanese, Marco Bellocchi, Luke Lamperti. They're the big names lining up in pink. Nairo Quintana too, just to throw one other into the mix. Still slogging away.
Yes, not doing the Tour de France for Movistar though, is he? I think his final Grand Tour as a professional will be the Vuelta, scheduled to retire at the end of the year, Quintana. It's an interesting start list, isn't it? Because there's Pogacar and he is there doing his final checks for the Tour de France, making sure he's exactly where he needs to be ahead of the Grand Depart in Barcelona. The rest of the field does have a look of riders who are looking to catch the eye and ride themselves into contention for one of those perhaps final one or two places in the Tour de France lineup that haven't yet been confirmed or, you know, sort of firmed up in the minds of the people who are selecting the teams, the sports directors. So it will be interesting to see who catches the eye and who manages to book themselves a last-minute trip to Barcelona.
Mm. Netcompany Ineos, the only rider that really stands out to me. Well, I suppose Andrew August, Tobias Foss, Lucas Hamilton, Mikhail Kwiatkowski. It's Kwiatkowski that stands out there. Axel Laurence, Brandon Smith-Rivera and Ben Swift line up for them. That's got a real kind of, with the best will in the world, a real kind of B-team feel, with the exception of Kwiatkowski. But they will have some decisions to make depending on how their injury list looks as we creep closer to the tour. The next thing, of course, you and I will be looking forward to is the Tour de France. You've already mentioned our preview episode, or episodes, I should say, because we're going to do it slightly differently this year, aren't we? Instead of doing that kind of big bumper episode and going into the runners and riders and the course, we're breaking it down into individual episodes where we're going to look at sort of those various aspects in not necessarily isolation, but certainly look at them one by one.
Indeed we are. That will be the week leading up to the Tour de France. Before then, we'll be back next week to go through what has happened at the Tour de Suisse. Has Tadej Pogacar ticked another World Tour stage race off the list of those that he needs to win? He's kind of collecting them, a bit like I'm collecting the World Cup Panini football stickers with my daughter at the moment. You know, he needs the Tour de Suisse. We still need Cristiano Ronaldo. So if anyone's got Cristiano Ronaldo, I'm all ears.
You've got the benefit of not needing pocket money, counting on your pocket money to be able to do it. And I'm not sure even if you complete it, I'm not sure that's valid. Because, you know, it should be a real struggle and it should be a real achievement. But if you could throw all the money of a professional man, at it, then I'm not sure that counts in the same way. But I suppose if your daughter is doing it too, I'm going to give you a pass.
Not that it's for me to say whether or not it counts. The pocket money is hers, and it's perfectly normal for a seven-year-old to have £200 pocket money a week paid in the form of Panini stickers. My goodness, it doesn't half add up, the cost.
Not quite that much,
well, but it's an expensive hobby that I, had I done my due diligence and realised there are 980 stickers in the book, and remembering my experience of collecting the Giro d'Italia Panini stickers a few years ago, where Richard sort of had to have a little quiet word when I totted up just how much we'd spent. It almost equaled his wine budget, you know? It was getting out of control.
That's how they get you. Well, I'm looking forward to hearing progress of that next week, how many shinies you need swapping and so on. Not long to go now. The time is going to go very quickly until the grand depart and until we leave. So I think we'd better leave it there for this week.
Indeed, Graham. I'll see you again next week.
Looking forward to it. Cheers.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freed, and Lionel Byrne.
Why have I asked my electrician I found on Angie.com to bury my pet hamster Nibbles in our yard for me? Because I was so moved by how carefully he buried my electrical wires, I knew I could trust him to bury my sweet Nibbles after his untimely end. Huh, Nibbles. Gone too soon. May he scurry in peace.
Hey, sorry about your pet, but I just wire stuff.
Nibbles would have loved you like a brother.
Connecting homeowners with skilled pros for over 30 years. Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find pros for all your home projects at Angie.com.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America. Discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear. Strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
When you're craving more of what you love, you'll find it in North Myrtle Beach. Treasure time together in a place that feels made for slowing down and soaking it all in. Enjoy classics like strolling to pristine beaches and unwinding over waterside dinners, or immerse yourself in adventures like kayaking through scenic waterways and horseback riding on the sand. Discover South Carolina's gem, North Myrtle Beach, where every day brings more of the activities you love. Plan your escape at ExploreNorthMyrtleBeach.com.